Welcome to the Above Politics Show.
Like it or not, we live in times of danger and uncertainty.
Dedicated to intelligent discussion and debate of serious political issues in the U.S. and around the globe.
Absolutely unrealistic.
Borrowing money from China to finance the war in Iraq.
From AbovePolitics.com, this is the Above Politics Show.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Above Politics Show. I am Homer Fife.
And I am Martin Bain.
Now, Martin, I understand that there's been a little bit of a stir in North Korea.
Yes, I've seen that. They've sort of tested another nuclear weapon, and then they've told South Korea that they're no longer going to be bound by the obligations of the treaty. No, it's not a armistice is the right word between the sort of NATO and North Korea at the end of the Korean War, and that if any ships are searched, any ships going to North Korean ports are searched, they'll then have to take matters into their own hands. And you have to think, ooh, see, this Kim Il-sung is a bit of a bit of a freakoid, a bit of a nutcase by the sounds of it.
Well, I'm wondering where it absolutely is a nutcase, and we've known it for some period of time, but I'm wondering where all these prognosticators are that stated that they were 5 years away from their first atomic bomb, and they were saying that there was no possibility they obtained the necessary technology to have a nuclear bomb. Well, I guess old nutcase Kim Jong-il showed them exactly where to put that.
You have to think where has he got his technology from? You know, you have to think he's probably got it, and I think there's evidence say he's probably got it from Pakistan.
I'm not going to completely rule out Russia. I'm not going to rule out Russia or China, either one. You know, what's good, you know, they're still looking, and right or wrong, I think they're still looking at the world with a Cold War attitude, and anything that causes us consternation, anything that causes us to have to feed more money into our defense budget and less money into our economy is going to be good for let's say, China, because China's looking at taking over the world economic scene. So, you know, every time a large company does a bankruptcy and we have to, or not, we don't have to, but the current administration filters these billions of dollars into it, somebody over China's laughing their butts off.
And that, you know, I think is very interesting, you know, and we sit on a conspiracy website, and do we honestly think that there are people in China who are actually having that kind of thought process?
They have to be. I mean, why wouldn't they be? I mean, let's take a look at the situation you have in Korea. We have 37,000 troops in South Korea, okay? That's a speed bump, right? That's nothing. 37,000 troops isn't going to stop anything. The reason that we have 37,000 troops over there is kind of, you know, the United States standing over there with their chest stuck out saying, okay, North Korea, if you do anything, you will get the United States involved. Well, here's the problem. Now, all of a sudden, 130-some days ago, we have an administration that probably isn't going to get involved. That if North Korea bulldozes over into South Korea, I don't believe Obama and his cronies will do anything more than what happened when they set off the atomic bomb. The UN issued a resolution. Ooh, I bet that just scared them to death, didn't it?
But you have to turn around and say, but you have to look at, say, the first Gulf War. You know, all of a sudden, you know, and I grant you, there is this magical product under the ground in the Middle East called oil, which probably changes and blinkers everyone's thought processes. But I can't see that the US has, you know, invested, you know, billions of dollars over since the armistice was agreed in South Korea, that it's really just going to walk away from that one, because, you know, How is anyone going to trust the US again if an ally, a long-standing ally such as South Korea, is, you know, bowled over by North Korean forces, and America says, yeah, okay, we'll go to the UN, we'll get you a resolution that says, oh, look, North Korea, you've been a naughty boy, guess what, take your ball home, and we'll just pretend this happened. Yeah, I just can't see that Barack Obama would have any option other than to talk to his military commanders and say, guys, you've got to fight another war. And there is some evidence to say that the US could actually have a major engagement in somewhere in the Korean Peninsula, because that type of war should be and would be different to what they're doing in Iraq and also in Afghanistan. Those are insurgency wars, where something in North Korea would be, I think, a much more traditional war.
I understand what you're saying, but you also have to take everything that you just said and now insert the nuclear option. And that's what's going to be the holdback. We will not, Martin, I am telling you, this administration will not risk a nuclear war with anyone. It's not going to happen. So if they think that North Korea is going to respond in a nuclear manner, I'm telling you, we won't do it. We will sacrifice those 37,000 troops, mostly Marines, and we will just let it go. And you know, I understand what you're saying, that the outlook for the rest of the world will be a horrible impact on the United States. However, I still can't get away from the fact that we're not going to risk a nuclear war, and this moron Kim Jong-il is just liable to start a nuclear war over this.
But let's be really cynical here, and I'm going to put on the biggest cynical hat I can. Do you really think that being the United Kingdom in the short term is that worried if, say, for example, over the Korean Peninsula they let off a few nuclear weapons?
Yeah, that's one way of looking at it. I mean, they, you know, other than selling a few transistors and small televisions, they really don't offer us anything. But we always have been, your country and mine, the two strongest supporters of South Korea. And, you know, they're still a country because of us. I mean, let's face it, that, you know, without us and the Korean War, they would not be a country now. So
yeah, I think we need to extend that a little bit and say, I know there was it wasn't just Britain and America that was involved in the UN operation. So I don't want people writing in that say that their fathers from, you know, from Australia, South Africa and other countries.
No, hold on a second, Martin. I agree there were other countries, but let's take a look at where the money came from. Let's take a look at where the majority of troops came from, where the majority of the military came from that stopped that. You're right. There were other countries. There were other countries involved in the Gulf War. There were other countries involved in the Iraq War. But, you know, when you're saying involved, what are you talking about? They sent 20 troops over?
Oh.
Did they send water purification specialists over? You know, I mean,
you're right. And I have to agree with you, but I just don't want people sort of, you know, ranting and raving at us because we sort of, forgot to mention that there were some other people involved. And I do absolutely accept your point that the vast majority of the investment in manpower, money and lives made in Korea, the Korean War, were typically American and British. And, you know, there's a regiment not too far away from me which no longer exists because I think it's been merged up with the Gloucesters, and the reason the Gloucesters have a long history in Korea as well. So,
and I'll say this, if they disagree, if they think that I'm out of place here, hey, they can flame me. That's right. Get on a thread and flame me. I'm saying it. I'm saying that if it wasn't for the United States and if it wasn't for England stepping in, most of your little small countries wouldn't even exist. There, okay. I just said it. Or you'd be speaking another language.
Let's see what happens on that. But I think you're right. It is very concerning. And you're right. I think, you know, if North Korea does do something, but you have to think, is the peninsula going to sort of be that underobserved that there's no, you know, several satellites in geosynchronous orbit over the Korean peninsula? You know, South Korea is a very technologically advanced country. You're trying to tell me that they haven't got drones running around, that they haven't got sensors all over there? It's not like North Korea is going to be able to sort of, you know, just absolutely catch everybody blind with their pants down, so to speak, and just invade the country. These days, that is a very difficult thing to do with the technology that exists. And you just have to think that the Americans have either moved a satellite or have several satellites that are over that part of the world, you know, with very short windows when there's no coverage, so that if they see something they can start to react to it. You're right, what can 37,000 US Marines and potentially, I've no idea what the size of the South Korean army is, I suspect that's probably, you know, hundreds of thousands, but you have to think those guys are probably going to fight pretty hard for their homeland.
Well, I would say yes, however, you have to understand there is a prevailing sentiment over there that both of those countries should be one country. You still have families that are broken up because of the situation over there. And a lot of people on both sides believe that it should be one country. So, you know, to say that the country is going to fight, you know, down to the last man type of thing, it is a good idea or ideologically, but I don't think that that's going to happen. But, you know, getting back to the economic thing of this, let's just say, for instance, there are several large economic powerhouses that are interested in stirring up the international economic situation just to see how the United States responds. Look at what we've got now. You know, we've got, what is it, 70% ownership now in General Motors here in the United States. We're becoming a socialist government. Now, how is the fact that, and look, folks, I'm going to say it. I threatened to, so I'm going to go ahead and say it. I told you so. I told you that if you voted Obama in, we would be a socialist government. And here we have the United States government owning 70% of a major corporation. So I told you so. But anyway, getting back to the point, how is a socialist government going to respond? We don't know. No one knows how the United States is going to respond to these things now, because the government has become something that it's never been before.
And that is an interesting point that I think people are not sure. And you're right, I suspect people do want to test Barack Obama. They do want to see the colour of his metal, so to speak, and will he, you know, when pushed, when nudged or prodded with this very large sword somewhere in the world, is he just going to go, oh, ow, don't do that again? Or is he just going to turn around and say, hang on a minute, the US military is still probably one of the most powerful across the world. Yeah, if you prod me with, you know, with the point of your sword, guess what? I'm going to hit you with a very large piece of 4x2 and you're going to wake up thinking that was a dumb thing to do. I'm not sure what Barack would do. I mean, I think one of the interesting things is that Robert Gates is still Secretary of Defense, which I think I think is something you and I discussed, you know. That is interesting that his reasoning was, well, because it gives some continuity. Yeah, I think it does, but, you know, why would you have someone who was clearly, you know, heavily involved in the Bush administration and, you know, was absolutely, must have been fairly well in favour of what happened in Iraq and Afghanistan, why would you keep that man on board if you didn't want someone strong at the Department of Defence running your defence strategy?
Well, maybe it's because they can't find a liberal that has any military service.
Ooh.
I mean, they can pick. Well, I mean, let's face it, Martin. Let's look at the last two presidents. You know, the last two Democratic presidents were what I like to affectionately call draft dodgers. Neither one of them had any military experience at all. And, you know, they might throw rotten eggs at George Bush's military experience, but you know what? That's all it is rotten eggs. He served honorably, and he has an honorable discharge. And the president before him, his dad, was a wartime hero, you know. And then we've got Bill Clinton, who didn't serve his country in any way, shape, or form. You have Obama, who didn't. Now, you know, I'm surprised. I am absolutely shocked and absolutely expected Colin Powell to be Secretary of Defense by now, you know, because he claims to be a Republican, but he's a rhino, and, you know, Republican in name only. I mean, he's as liberal as the day is long, and I'm thoroughly shocked that Mr. Gates hasn't been replaced by Mr. Powell, and I fully expect that to happen. And I don't see that as being a horribly bad thing, because Powell has a lot of experience. But, I mean, what are your thoughts on that?
Well, yeah, I mean, you know, there's no doubting Colin Powell's military experience and, you know, and what he did in the first Gulf War. But how much of an influence does the views of the Secretary of Defense actually have? Because ultimately, if the Commander-in-Chief says, guess what, chaps, we're going to not invade this country or we're going to do something, he is Commander-in-Chief. Barack Obama is Commander-in-Chief. He can just go to somebody and say, guess what, I'm Commander-in-Chief, I don't like this, right, you start planning for a military operation to do X, Y, and Z. Now, it doesn't matter whether the Secretary of Defense agrees or disagrees. It's his job. When his boss says to him, I'm Commander-in-Chief, run along, monkey do, he runs along and does.
To a point. You know, to a point, I agree with you. And as far as him giving orders to his Secretary of Defense, you're correct. However, there is only a certain amount Obama can do without the Congress behind him. But let's face it, the Congress is going to support him. I mean... We have liberals in charge of the Congress. We have liberals in charge of the Senate. There's nobody going to stop him. He can do whatever he wants. The problem is going to be, I don't think he's going to do that much. I really don't. He is not action-oriented. He's not going to want to pull us into a war. I mean, look at the economic situation we're in. He's having to buy companies right and left, or, you know, I'm saying having to. I personally think this has been his idea all along, is to take control of some of the larger corporations in the United States and hence further the socialist ideal. But,
you know,
and I don't know, what do you think?
And, you know, talking very much on the socialist ideal, making a quick movement away, is, you know, all of a sudden I hear that sometime maybe in the next, and this show's been recorded on Sunday, that GM in the States will probably be filing for Chapter 11, which means, actually, I'm a bit embarrassed by my prediction when I said maybe one of the major three automotive companies in the States would go under. I'm a bit embarrassed. I only said one. Maybe I should have said two. The third one, I suspect, you know, I don't think Ford's going to file, but I just think it is interesting that, you know, GM has no alternative now but to turn around and say, guess what? I want protection from my creditors because, my, you know, I've run my business so badly. Mr. Government, thanks for all the money, but guess what? It's not enough, and I'm going to just go and seek protection via the courts.
You know, and that's fine. But the problem here is that's not just being allowed to happen. The federal bankruptcy courts would give them protection from their creditors, and it should be just allowed to happen, but that's not what's being allowed to happen. What's happening is the government is going to step in and take a 70% stake in General Motors. Now, look, you call it what you want. That's socialism. Socialism is the ownership of major corporations in a country by the government. There's, you know, you can, there's, I've heard it called squishy socialism and quasi socialism. You call it what you want. The fact of the matter is, it is socialism. And what needs to happen with General Motors is exactly the same thing that me and you talked about before when all of this bailout stuff started. They need to take their licks. A lot of people are going to lose their jobs. Plants are going to shut down. But hey, that's the way of the system. And look, let's face it, Martin. We are no longer a producing country. We will not be a producing country. Anytime we're paying our laborers effectively twice as much money as their competitors, and their competitors, i.e. Honda, Toyota, Nissan, are producing a better product, we cannot compete in the production market. It's just not going to happen. So these old dinosaurs like GM and Chrysler, who are still trying to compete, they need to either completely revamp and get their pay scale down, which is not going to happen because of the United Auto Workers, but that's the only way they're going to survive. The only way they're going to survive is to cut costs by cutting their wages and produce a competitive product, and it's not happening. And as long as the government steps in and holds them by the hand, it's still not going to happen.
And yeah, and you're right, the implications here are not just in North America, but they're also fairly heavily in Europe, and there's been a lot of discussion in, particularly in Germany, about the partner that the German government prefers to take over GM Europe, which predominantly has Opel and the Vauxhall brands. Now, Vauxhall and probably Opel, probably very little known outside of Europe. But it is interesting that Fiat was one of the people who were interested in buying GM Europe, and they were talking about having a tie-up with Chrysler. What I think is even more interesting here, and it's a partner which I'm told is now more preferred by the German government, is that a major tier one component supplier company out of Canada called Magna are now sort of preferred by the German government to buy the European arm of GM, which I think is quite interesting in that you've got a company who have supplied components into the tier one automotive are saying, we want to step up. We believe that the methodology and the concepts that we've got in being a supplier to the automotive industry can actually help us sell and promote the brands. Because I think in Europe, they're probably more profitable than they are in the US. But yeah, in the UK, potentially, we've got 5,000 to 6,000 direct jobs, and probably 35,000 to 40,000 indirect jobs based on that decision alone. In Germany, yeah, it's magnitudes that much larger, and in Belgium, it's magnitudes much larger. So you're probably looking at maybe 40,000 direct jobs and potentially maybe 250,000 indirect jobs that are dependent on this.
Yeah, and let's face it, Martin. that's the way it's supposed to work. If you have a corporation in, here in the United States who's working in basically a closed border mode, okay, they're not going to exist, because what's happened is the world has become economically global. I don't think there's a single person that can argue with me on that. Now, there's some that may not want that to happen. There's a lot of people against NAFTA and that sort of thing, and European free trade, and China being made favored nation status. But let's face it, without global economics, a corporation and or a country is going to die. So the fact that fiat has moved in here, and since we talked last, we had done our last show, I've done a lot of study on this, Martin, and fiat moving into Chrysler is a fantastic idea. It takes it globally. Chrysler all of a sudden becomes a true economic corporation. Now, I'm not talking about the fact, yes, Chrysler sells cars in Europe, General Motors sells cars in Europe, but they're not truly global because they're not owned by a global facility. So this company, this corporation, what's the name of it that's coming to General Motors? I'm sorry, I'm kind of behind.
Magna is a Canadian automotive component supplier to probably all the major, probably every automotive.
Fantastic. Fantastic. Let Magna come in. Let them invest their money and their resources into General Motors. Get the pay scale down. Get the product quality up. Get them at a competitive mode, which is what I'm hoping Fiat does to Chrysler. And these people can retain their jobs. Now, look, there's a lot of crying about losing jobs. Well, they wouldn't lose their jobs if they would accept a job at something less than $75 an hour. But that's the problem. You're getting Toyota workers and Honda workers and Nissan workers making $35 to $40 on average an hour. The United States auto worker won't accept anything less than $70. Well, boo-hoo. You know, I'd like to make $70 an hour. I'd love it for just, you know, just a couple of years, and then I'll retire. But you know what? I can't. So I maintain the job that I have. I don't just say, okay, let's close my company down because I'm not making $70 an hour.
And I suspect that, you know, that's one of the reasons that Chrysler and GM are in Chapter 11. And it is interesting to see whether anyone will be prepared to turn around and take on the Auto Workers Union, just to turn around and say, guess what, guys? This isn't going to happen. What are you going to do? You know, because I, you know, maybe there needs to be someone very strong who takes over, you know, GM yes. in the US and Chrysler in the US, and just stares these guys down and say, guess what? You have a choice. It's either $45 an hour or you put 250,000-300,000 people out of work. And I just wonder what the unions will do. Well, you know, clearly the union bosses will turn around and say, oh, this is wrong. But those guys are probably on probably good 6- or 7-figure remuneration packages from their unions to be head of the Auto Workers Union. I suspect the head of Auto Workers Union doesn't have to worry about his job or his pension, and he's probably being paid significantly more than $70 an hour.
Yeah, I'm sure. So, and you know, and here's another thing that you have to understand, too, I think, is the fact that the United Auto Workers is nothing but a wing of the Democratic Party. I mean, they always have been. You know, they're one of the largest contributors to the Democratic Party. So a lot of people that are sitting in the House and Senate now, and even Obama to an extent, owe where they're at to the United Auto Workers. So how hard are they going to step on their toes? It's going to be interesting to see.
It will be, but I suspect in Europe it'll be Magna takes them over. Magna is a company that professionally I know of. They will come in there and take that ethos, which I think will be no bad thing. And I can only think that's going to be a good thing for General Motors in Europe and potentially.
Well, let me make one more little comment here, Martin. It will be a good thing, but Magna's going to have to deal with Obama, because Obama's going to own General Motors. That's going to be the rub.
Well, he's going to own General Motors in the States, but part of the Chapter 11 will be to split off General Motors in Europe and sell it to either Fiat or to Magna. That's what is being planned at the moment. So you will have, in reality, a GM that is US-based, and you will have a new company in Europe that was General Motors in Europe, which is typically the Opel brand and the Vauxhall brand, and General Motors in the States will have nothing to do with them.
Wouldn't I love to see General Motors in Europe just take off, just light a fire under them and take off, and let them start handling a large percentage of the automotive industry over there and make tremendous amounts of money and be tremendously successful. I would love to see that.
And you have to be thinking that Magna aren't going in there because they feel sorry for the workers at General Motors across Europe. They're going in there because they think they can make a ton load of money. And yes, it would be great if all of a sudden, you know, there was another very large European automotive powerhouse to turn around and say, hey, guys, it's easy to do.
Yeah, and same thing with Fiat. Fiat's not doing it because they feel sorry for anybody. They're doing it because they think they can make money.
Yeah, exactly. And talking of Europe, we have some elections coming up for the EU this week. The UK votes on Thursday, and then I think it's across Europe over Friday and the weekend. And something like 375 million Europeans get to vote over these 4 days, which I think it will be interesting to look at the results once it's out and study the results country by country to see how many people are interested. But here in the UK, you know, we're in the middle of still, I think it's something like day 25 or day 30 of revelations about our MPs' expenses, and they're still being trolled out. And many people are concerned that voters are either going to punish the ruling parties in the UK by either not voting, which I have to say I'm a little concerned about, because, you know, I'm a big fan of, well, you have a right to vote, you should use it, or that some of the smaller parties may well get some representations within the EU Parliament as a result of these elections. And I just think it's great fun, and anything that punishes or smacks the complacency that a clique of ruling parties have, you know, I think can be no bad thing. And it'd be interesting to see whether in the States that might ever happen, where people might actually decide to punish the Republicans or the Democrats and say, actually, we're going to vote for, you know, 25% of the House of Representatives and the Senate to be independents.
Well, I have a question. First off, what exactly is up in the EU elections? And I've read somewhere that I believe that Turkey's bid to join the EU is going to become, that's one of the big issues here?
Well, basically, we have a European Parliament, and I suppose people may flame me and shoot me for this one, but guess what, Homer and I, we're tough people, we don't really care about that one.
Flame us,
do it. Basically, I suppose I'm trying to think the best way to describe it is like in your state. So you have an administration within the state, and then you have an administration across the whole country. The best way to describe what's happening in Europe this week is you've got each country has its own parliament, similar to each state, and then above that there is an EU Parliament, which probably has less powers than your federal government, but that is what we are voting for. We are voting for people to represent constituencies and areas in each European country at the European Parliament. So they are our representatives on a sort of grand federal European basis. And Turkey is very interesting. How many people want Turkey to come into the EU? I think people are fairly sort of either side of this one. It's yes or no. I haven't found many people who sit on the fence on this one. Well, why would you want Turkey in the EU? Well, it sits what is traditionally regarded as the sort of border between Europe and Asia.
Oh, yeah, and that's caused problems for them in the past.
It has.
I see here that the French president has come out and just flat out said no, he doesn't want them in. My question is Turkey is not a small country economically. Wouldn't it benefit the EU by bringing them in?
I actually don't think so, because I don't think that Turkey's infrastructure is as developed as it needs to be a member of the EU. All that will happen is that, you know, countries that have joined the EU in the last, since the EU's come along, and you've been a country whose infrastructure, so your roads, your public services and all those type of things, typically gets huge sums of money from the EU to improve those things, which can be no bad thing. And Ireland is a country that has benefited from membership of the EU, in that, you know, there's been a lot of infrastructure, a lot of roads have been put in, you know, high quality roads have been put in. Now, of course, Ireland's economy, whilst it's being hammered a little bit, but Ireland is no longer seen as a country that needs huge handouts from the EU, whereas Turkey potentially is a country, and you know, there are a lot of parts of Turkey that are less developed than the major cities, that is going to need a huge amount of money from Europe. Where's that money going to come from? It's going to come from those developed countries, so it's going to come from the likes of the UK, Germany, France, Italy, Spain.
Martin, let's not forget that Turkey has been one of those countries that traditionally has stood up and has fought with us in every major campaign that I can think of. I mean, Turkey was very
except for the First World War.
Granted, I'll give you that. In the Korean War, in the Vietnam War, Turkey sent many, many soldiers in there and stood by us. And they've always been a good, strong.
But that's at a UN level, not at an EU level. It will be interesting to see. Now, you know, depending on whether, certainly in the UK, whether British electorate can be bothered to go and vote, which I suspect is probably going to happen more, that, you know, turnout will be even lower than it typically is for a European election.
Really?
I mean, I suspect if turnout for the European elections is 25% of the electorate, between 25 and 30%, I would be surprised. I'd be very surprised if it even gets that high, because most people think, well, they're hundreds of miles away, they're all on the gravy train, they're all, you know, claiming expenses, and what do they actually deliver? That's what I suspect most people will say, and there are going to be people who are listening to this show on the website going, but the ideals of the EU, great. Come on the show thread, convince everybody else about those. But I suspect most people in the UK aren't really that interested in the EU elections. Two things are going to happen. Low turnout, but I think that low turnout, when people vote, they will probably vote for some of the smaller parties that are represented, not the big three, Labour, Conservative and the Liberal Party.
I mean, and I can understand that, Martin, just outside looking in here. Your country is one of those countries that is not going to benefit that much from the EU, and yet is going to have your resources thrown into a pool. You're going to be one of the big contributors to the EU, as opposed to one of the big people that takes advantage of it, what they offer.
Yeah, I mean, we do also have something. There is a rebate back to the United Kingdom that was negotiated by Margaret Thatcher when she was Prime Minister, that even today still exists, and no Labour politician has decided that he wants to. I'm sure Europe would only be too delighted not to pay the rebate back to the United Kingdom, because that's a significant sum of money, but no politician in the UK is prepared to say, I'm going to forego that, because that means we're going to be paying, you know, potentially billions more, as you quite rightly say, into EU coffers that are going to help countries that aren't mined. And you know, in this current economic climate, you know, I'm a big fan of saying, well, if I'm going to spend money, why don't I spend money at home first? Look after my people first. When my country's happy, my country's healthy, my country's prosperous, then I can actually start to think about, okay, I've got a few bucks spare, I can go and help somebody else. Why would I help somebody else when I'm going to be putting myself out of pocket?
I agree. I agree 100%. Now, if you could just kind of explain something to me, though, Martin. I've read here that this election may actually put into place 18 virtual European MPs. What does that mean?
I've not sort of seen that one about virtual MPs. I mean, I'm not entirely sure what they're actually meaning by virtual MPs. I mean, if you take the concept of a virtual MP as someone that doesn't exist or someone who isn't going to be in Parliament. So I've not sort of seen that one, but I suspect it could be that people are going to say, well, hey, I can't be in Europe all the time. Let's find a way to do it.
I believe, Martin, is there's 18 that will not take office until the Lisbon Treaty takes effect.
Now that's even more interesting, in that the Lisbon Treaty currently cannot be ratified because there are going to be some referendums in Ireland, because Ireland voted no, and now the EU hierarchy have turned around and said, well, guess what, Ireland, we're not entirely sure you understood the question properly, so what we're going to do is we're going to give you the chance to think about the question again and maybe change the answer. So, you know, this is, and I just have a huge problem with this. Sorry. If, you know, this happened in other countries in Europe that the, you know, the ruling European elite said, guess what? You're going to get another chance to vote on this one. And by the fact we're giving you the chance to vote on it, you might get the clue that the answer you gave last time was wrong. Sorry, if a country votes yes or no in favour of something, that's it. You don't go back to the electorate and say, yeah, I'm not sure you understood the question properly.
Yeah, what is that? I mean, that's kind of like saying, okay, we're only going to accept your vote if it's the way we want it. I mean, that's ridiculous.
And that's basically what they're doing here. It's basically what they're saying is, guess what? You, the people of Ireland who, you know, a majority of them voted against the Lisbon Treaty ratification, EU is basically saying to them, guess what? You're thick. You obviously didn't understand the question. We're going to give you a chance to get it right. Fundamentally, I hope the Irish people just turn around and actually vote it down even harder, just to send a message to say, guess what, we voted once, we've made our decision, go and change it and come back and offer us something new.
And if they do that, then these 18 virtual Euro MPs will just go away.
Yes, because they will take their seats once the, well, they will remain there until the treaty is either absolutely dead or it's ratified. Once they're ratified, then they'll become, you know, fully fledged members of the EU, which, and I suspect Ireland will be bullied into, you know, its electorate will be bullied into making the right decision, because that's what the EU elite want.
Right, but you know, you're saying be bullied into making the right decision. You mean they'll be bullied into making the decision that the EU wants.
Oh, yes, all right, yes, you're absolutely right.
That's the problem, though, isn't it? When you've got such a large organization holding the purse strings, they can bully these smaller countries into voting and going along with them.
Absolutely. I'm absolutely in agreement with that one. And it's going to be interesting to see whether, you know, certainly in the UK and other parts of Europe, whether a lot of anti-EU parties get elected. But I suspect once our MPs get there and discover the gravy train, how many of them are actually going to work to put themselves out of work? Not one. So, and one of the things that interested me is I noticed that President Obama has got his first appointment on the Supreme Court. You have a new judge on the Supreme Court, Sotomayor.
Yes, and I am 100% torn in half over this, because let's face it, she is as liberal as just about as they get, but not quite. You know, there's a lot of people up in arms over her because she's basically anti-Second Amendment. The Second Amendment of the Constitution states that a strong and prudent militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be denied. And that's it. It's a very short, succinct amendment to the Constitution. And she's basically saying that it can be restricted by states' rights going back to the 10th Amendment. So she has some things that are very controversial to the Republican Party. And she's also basically a racist. I mean, and what I mean by that, let me give you this statement she's made, Martin, and you being over there in England, you tell me what you think. Her statement says, quote, "I would hope that a wise Latina woman with the richness of her experiences would more often than not reach a better conclusion than a white male who hasn't lived that life." Now, how does that hit you, Martin?
I'd have to say that would sort of, you know, make me sort of not exactly want to go out and have dinner or sit across a dinner table with this person. I'd be a little bit annoyed being, I make no bones about it, a white male. You know, what gives her life richness that my life doesn't have? Yes, that would probably annoy me a little bit, and I'd probably then have to question any judgment she made, because she's clearly just said to me, because I'm a white male and I haven't lived her life, I can't make the same decisions. Well, you could flip that round and say, hang on a minute, you're a Latino woman, you haven't lived my life, how can you make any, how can your decision and thought processes be better than mine?
Well, yeah, and now let me tell you something. I think that one of the things that's kind of struck me as coming out against her is the fact that three out of the last four of her rulings have been overturned. So, you know, she's not a successful judge. And I'm just wondering if, you know, President Obama isn't simply putting her in place because of her sex and her race. You know, because it can't be her record. I mean, her record's horrible. You know, I mean, she's constantly, like I said, the last three out of the four of her rulings were overturned by a higher court. So,
but you have to think that, you know, how long will Judge Sotomayor potentially be on, you know, will be one of the chief judges in the states until what? Until she dies?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's a life appointment, and she's very young. So, there's every opportunity she could be there for literally decades.
Yeah, and this is what they've always said, is that, you know, presidents will always try to have an opportunity to stuff their particular leanings of judges onto the Supreme Court, because that has implications. You're right. I mean, she could be making decisions. She could be making decisions in another 5 or 6 presidents' time,
easily. And now, the one saving grace here is she's replacing a liberal judge, so we're not really going to lose anything, you know, as far as conservatives go. The justice that she's replacing is just as liberal as the day is long. So she's not really going to go in there and make any, there's not going to be any drastic changes, in other words. But I just want to bring up one of these cases real quick, Martin, if we have the time.
Sure, we do.
One of the cases that I think has really hit a pinpoint on this is there was a group of firefighters here who took a promotional exam for a promotion to lieutenant, okay, and I'm not going to get into the specifics on how many or whatever, but regardless, all of the applicants that scored high enough to be promoted were white with one Latino, all right? There were no black applicants that scored high enough to even qualify for the promotion. The fire department disqualified the entire application process and promoted the black applicants because they said they needed more, diversity within the fire department. So the white firefighters who took the exam and scored higher sued, and it went all the way up to her court, and she ruled against them. And so that's become kind of a thorn in her side too.
And we call that, you know, that in the UK has been called positive discrimination. And
right.
I have to say,
reverse racism here.
Yeah, whereas I do have a big problem with that one. You know, I believe, you know, that you should be promoted on your merits, and you know, you have to think, you know, being a firefighter is the kind of job where, you know, you've got to be able to jump, and you've got to respect your boss. You know, you've got to respect your chain of command, that when they say, by the way, go into that burning building, etc., I mean, you've got to have absolute confidence. And I think, you know, that can be a very dangerous thing. You know, people who put their lives on the line are going to turn around and say, hang on a minute, well, this person's in charge of me, not because they're the best candidate, but because someone decided that we need to have more diversity in our organization. And I think that's a very dangerous thing.
Very dangerous. I agree. And now, here's another comment, I think, from that needs to be said about when Obama put her up for nomination. He said that she brings the empathy and emotion to the Supreme Court that is needed. Now, see, here's the problem that I have, Martin. I don't know how familiar you are with our Supreme Court, but all they are supposed to do is take cases that are presented to them and determine whether these cases are applicable to the Constitution, and if they are applicable, whether they are correct or not in their interpretation of the Constitution of the United States. Empathy and emotion is not supposed to play a part in this. I don't care whether she feels sorry because of somebody who was brought before, or some case that is brought before her, and she's sitting there crying her eyes out. I could care less. She is supposed to rule as to the constitutionality of the case and whether it was constitutional or not. And that sort of thing just sickens me. And what's been brought into our whole political system because of this is the fact that the liberals operate on a pure emotional basis and care nothing about the facts. And I could get on a soapbox for an hour about this, Martin, but I mean, what do you think of that?
Well, I have to say, you know, if you're there to make a judicial decision, you must make the judicial decision based on the evidence in front of you, and then I'm trying to think what the word is, the precedents set by a document that you have in front of me. So if she's, you know, has to make a decision on whether, you know, a case chumped up to her is is in line with the Second Amendment or not in the Second Amendment. I do agree that it should be fairly black and white, but we have to recognize here, Homer, that these people are human, and it doesn't matter how much that we expect them to make decisions based on, well, is this in line with the First, Second, Third, Fourth, Fifth Amendments? They will always still blinker and judge that decision based on their own personal experiences.
Right, right. And I'll tell you, I would give a note of caution to those people who are verbally and who are writing letters to their congressmen and their senators about this appointee. You could get a whole lot worse than Sotomayor, okay? Granted, she may be a little racist, she may be a little opinionated, and she may be very emotional in her decisions. However, she does have a record of not always siding with the more liberal area of whatever case she's presented to. She does have a record of occasionally crossing the line. And you know what? President Obama can put whoever he wants up there that's qualified, and we could get a whole lot worse than her. So, you know, every once in a while you have to be careful what you wish for, because you just might get it.
Absolutely. And of course, wishing for things means that Homer and I hope that if you want to say something, you can come along to the show thread and post away. If we see stuff, we will come back to you. I do want to put a shout out to someone who posted on the last show thread, who said that he and his wife download the show and listen to us. So we have a new listener on board. So we want to thank you very much for that. Nice, you know, I think he maybe even mentioned that he and his wife listened to it in the bed as well. So, hey, you and I, you know, we know we're that good. So,
yeah.
So, but
I'm leaving that one alone, Martin.
I'll probably dig with it. But we are, you know, running probably over time a little bit. But hey, tough. Guess what? I just want to thank you for listening to the Above Politics Show.
I'm Homer Fife.
And I'm Martin Bain. And we'll see you next time on the Above Politics Show.
You've been listening to the Above Politics Show. If you have a comment, suggestion, or an opposing view, please deliver it at abovepolitics.com. The views expressed on the Above Politics Show do not necessarily reflect the staff and management of the Above Network LLC or any of its affiliates. Thanks for listening, and please continue to deny apathy.